From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Welcome, Anita and Michael.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here are the issues. Wrapping up a two-day NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, President Biden delivered an address highlighting how Washington and its allies are supporting Ukraine, defending democratic values, and taking action to address global challenges. Turkey agreed to forward to Parliament Sweden's bid to join NATO. NATO says Ukraine's future lay inside the alliance, but stopped short of naming a date. Ukraine's future membership was the most divisive and emotionally charged issue at this year's summit. The future of a Russia-Ukraine agreement to export Ukrainian grain to world markets is again in doubt, as Moscow threatens to not renew it after it expires this Sunday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken defended the Biden administration's decision to send cluster munitions to Ukraine, saying it was a decision of last resort in the face of supply constraints. Here in the U.S., lawmakers said that if finalized, the deal between the PGA Tour and Saudi-backed Live TV could give Saudi Arabia an outsized role in American sports. House Republicans unloaded a barrage of criticism directed toward FBI Director Christopher Wray, outlining a litany of complaints while Wray testified before the House Judiciary Committee. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Anita, NATO leaders met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky as they closed the NATO summit in Lithuania's capital, reiterating support for Kyiv to join the alliance, but stopping short of any specific commitments of timeline that Zelensky has sought. And this came a day after Zelensky blasted NATO's lack of a clear timetable. So does he understand why the U.S. and other allies do not want to fast track a membership for Ukraine?
Right. So on Tuesday, you heard those words from President Zelensky. And then on Wednesday, he struck a significantly more conciliatory tone, saying, yes, indeed, he did understand and was happy with the outcome, which is basically a very loose promise backed up by a new organization called the NATO-Ukraine Council that has some actual decision-making authority that will work on getting Ukraine ready for its eventual NATO membership. Just for those who haven't tuned into this whole drama, the reason that Ukraine cannot join NATO today is that NATO membership requires your country not to be at war currently. And as we know, Ukraine is in the middle of a war. If Ukraine were to join today, that would mean that Article 5 would be immediately invoked, which means it's collective defense. And so everybody would have to come to Ukraine's aid. That would put NATO in direct conflict with Moscow. This is not desirable. Nobody wants to start World War III. So this is kind of an in-between step. Ukraine does need to make a bunch of reforms, rule of law reforms, military reforms, democratization reforms, before they can be considered a proper NATO ally.
Agreed with everything that was just said. It's very, very clear why Ukraine cannot immediately join this alliance. It would require jumping into a war that would essentially be World War III. Again, nobody wants that, especially not the Biden administration committing to troops where we still have sort of this stench from the withdrawal from Afghanistan lingering in the air, an election on the horizon. These are complications that the administration does not want, both as a governing entity and as a campaigning entity. I think it's just interesting to note to me overall how relevant, once again, the NATO summit has become. You know, in past years, it was something that didn't really generate topics that were front page news. And it's just 5 years ago that you had President Trump attending a NATO summit and putting the United States' whole commitment to the alliance in question, and then standing on a platform and taking Vladimir Putin's side over U.S. intelligence regarding Putin's mischief. Just 5 years later, you have Biden's administration leading a historic expansion of the alliance and solidifying its role in U.S. democracy, diplomacy, and defense strategies. it's just very interesting to see the evolution of that whole enterprise over the course of such a very short period of time. And yes, Zelensky didn't want to appear to be overplaying his hand. And for a moment, it appeared that he did. When you have the U.S. committing, I believe, in excess of $113 billion to the Ukrainian war effort in both military and domestic aid, the last thing that leader needs to appear is ungrateful. I think you realize that a slow, steady, and sure track to membership while securing the support of the U.S., NATO nations, and other nations during this period, his period of war, is the way to go. That is the method for him to be an effective leader and bring his country out of this situation successfully.
Yeah, those are some really good points that you all brought out. And also, now that Sweden will be joining NATO, all five Nordic countries are part of the military alliance, and that would be Finland, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, and of course, in Sweden. So what will this mean for Russia now?
Basically a wall of ice on their eastern flank. I mean, Russia's army in previous decades and centuries has tussled with many of these players and come out the worse for it. So this is definitely a warning to Moscow. And Moscow has reacted very negatively to Sweden and Finland joining NATO, saying that it will have, quote, negative consequences. I'm not sure what that means, coming from Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, who's ominous at the best of times. So I'm not sure what they mean by that. But what we did see pretty much immediately after this summit concluded was drone strikes on Kyiv for the third day in a row. So Russia is obviously very angry about this and is not wavering in their insistence on continuing this conflict.
Yeah, agreed. The Russian military is very, very familiar with the formidable nature of those nations that have been added to the NATO alliance. They have not had historic success against expansion in that direction. The ultimate goal is to get people to the table to talk and turn this into a diplomatic effort, then into a military effort. Hopefully, this expansion, this sense of inevitability about the Russian army or military being fenced and held back by this alliance that's surrounding it, essentially, that hopefully the Russians will realize that it's beneficial to them to come to the table and work out some sort of situation where you can get peace. Because President Biden pointed it out, he called it like something out of the 14th century with the brutality towards civilians in this conflict. It's just stunning. So, I mean, we talk about the expansion of war effort and billions of dollars in munitions. And even, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, the types of munitions that are being used in this conflict. I believe it's important not to forget about the people aspect of it. There are people dying every day. And it's important that we get to a position where we start to talk about the cessation of conflict here so that we can save lives and move forward.
Let me just make one point that Michael brought up about the brutality of this particular conflict, because I think people listening to this broadcast around the world would counter that and say that all conflicts, especially those with great powers engaged in them, have the capacity to be especially brutal. I just don't want to talk over that level of suffering that people around the world have endured at the hands of proxy wars. So this war is really brutal in a lot of ways, but I think our audience has experienced a lot of that brutality firsthand, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. Speaking of Ukraine's very vague path to NATO, I think cynically you could also see this as incentivizing Kyiv to hurry up and get to the negotiating table. And what's interesting about that is that Zelensky appears to be in no hurry to do so. He wants all of his territory back. He wants all of the pre-2014 territory back before he will even consider speaking to Moscow. And one could see NATO saying, okay, well, you can join the alliance if you get your act together, as putting the finger on the scale towards getting Ukraine to the negotiating table. But it really remains to be seen how this counteroffensive is going to go, how the next few months are going to go. And more importantly, Ukraine has an election that has to happen early next year. And Zelensky has said that he will not hold elections while there is still martial law in the country. Now, there are very reasonable reasons to say that. I mean, it's very hard to stand up an election. It's very expensive. It's very dangerous. There are security considerations even in societies that are at peace. But the interesting thing is Zelensky has approval numbers that Joe Biden would kill for. He's somewhere between 70 and 91% approval ratings. So it wouldn't really hurt him to go to the polls. But These are all things that Ukraine has to think about as they continue on this path, because they are very much a player here. They have decisions to make just as much as anybody else.
Yes. And we'll just have to see, like you mentioned, how this counteroffensive is going to play out. Another aspect of that, there are concerns that Russia will not extend a United Nations brokered deal that allows grain to flow from Ukraine to parts of the world struggling with hunger, with ships no longer heading to Ukraine's Black Sea ports and food exports dwindling. So it seems Russia is continuing to use this deal as a political tool in their war against Ukraine. Is this part of their plan?
That's definitely what the Ukrainian leadership is accusing Putin of doing. What's interesting about this grain deal, it was brokered by Turkey, which now puts President Erdogan in a totally awkward position because he just relented and let the NATO alliance expand to include Sweden, which has a very large army, a very capable army. And now he has to go to the table and talk to Putin about letting the ships through the port of Odessa so he can feed the world. You know, every time I look at this particular deal, I look back at the life and times of one Vladimirovich Putin and the fact that he is the only surviving son of his parents, and his two older brothers died amid the siege of Leningrad, the 1942 blockade of the city, where about 800,000 people starved to death over 2 years. It was brutal. It was horrible. It was one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. If you take that into account and consider that part of Putin's origin story and the way he views the world, he probably does not see this threat of hunger in the same way that I think a lot of other people might. He has come out of it, his family has come out of it, and he probably just has a different perspective on it and might be more willing to weaponize this deal to achieve his ends.
It's a very interesting perspective on, you know, the mind and psychology of Vladimir Putin. And again, that's one set of dark hallways that I personally would not want to try to tread in. Having said that, I think he's made it very clear that he's willing to weaponize virtually any and all advantages that he feels he may have, whether it's energy resources going to Western Europe or grain going to the rest of the world. Besides those two products, the main product of Russia is mischief. He is absolutely willing to extend this, use this to whatever advantage that he sees possible. I believe there's another aspect of this deal where he is trying to regain access to the SWIFT banking system, the international banking system. That part of this deal for allowing the grain to continue to flow is renewed Russian access to this banking system, which I think is a key part of Putin's ability to move money around that he gets from whatever sources in the world, be it from Wagner, from other military mischief, whatever. The ability to have access to this banking system, I think, is critical to his ability to intake and develop his funds. So what his motivations are, I could not say, but it's very clear that he is willing to weaponize virtually anything at his disposal.
Thanks. You all brought up some really interesting perspectives. And also wanted to touch on, and Michael, you brought it up earlier, the cluster munitions that the Biden administration says it would send to Ukraine. U.S. allies as well as human rights groups have criticized this decision. And the Biden administration has also faced outrage from some key Democrats on Capitol Hill who broke with the president publicly over the decision. So why is it that the Biden administration has decided to do this?
The reason that the White House is given is that the production lines for 155 rounds, which are badly needed in this conflict, has dried up. They need some time to ramp it back up. So they need a stopgap, and cluster munitions, which about 120 countries have sworn off, but the United States has not, are going to fill the gap. The problem with these weapons is that they're horribly indiscriminate. They have a great track record of killing children and civilians. And Zelensky's pushed back against this, saying, I didn't hear you complaining when Russia was using these cluster munitions, which is not true. People have complained a lot about Russia's actions on the battlefield, basically saying we're really struggling here. We need these munitions to gain a bit more ground. But the reason the administration says they're providing them is this: it's a simple supply issue. But of course, they've gotten a lot of flack for it from within Biden's party over this decision, because it is indeed controversial, because these are really dreadful weapons.
add into that and say that, you know, of the 100 or so countries that have banned these weapons, they include a number of NATO countries. The UK, France, Germany have signed international treaties that outlaw the use or stockpiling of these weapons. So it is significant that the U.S. has decided to get into this. The 155 round, by the way, is an artillery shell, which is used by the thousands, again, noting the amount of munitions that are being used on a daily basis. Think about that. Thousands of shells are being used, and it does create a shortage. Also correct that the Russians are using cluster munitions. One of the justifications for this that was used by the U.S. is that if we talk about this weapon, it's basically a lot of little bombs inside of a big bomb. You drop it from the air, a lot of little bombs fall to the ground. Most of them explode, some of them don't. So it's all these little unexploded pieces of ordnance that presented danger to the civilian public. One justification is that the failure rate of these little bomblets is about 2%, as opposed to the reported failure rate of the Russian munitions as about 30 to 40%. The other justification is that Ukraine is using these munitions to protect its own ground. They're not using it in an offensive way on somebody else's turf. They're using them to protect their own domestic well-being. So the justifications are there for using them. Clearly, the danger is still there as well. But this is a tough decision by the Biden administration. And again, I think it was significant that he did face pushback from his own party in using these. And that is justified as well. The pushback is certainly justified.
Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, a look at some of the latest developments on Capitol Hill. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Well, here in the U.S., lawmakers said that if finalized, the deal between the PGA Tour and the Saudi-backed LIV Golf could give Saudi Arabia an outsized role in American sports. And Michael, what will this deal, if finalized, mean for the future of professional golf?
Yeah, I report a lot on the golf industry, and the situation is that, number one, the deal has not been finalized. Let's get that clear right up front. There was a competing global golf tour that was started by the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, which decided to take millions of dollars and create this sort of competitive entity to the PGA Tour, which is the global largest tour, generating billions of dollars in endorsements and ticket revenues and all sorts of things. It is basically the face. It's what people know as professional golf. There have been cases where in other sports where the Saudis have attempted to create satellite entities, most well known in the area of soccer/football, depending on what part of the world you're coming from. They bought players and created the Saudi leagues and, you know, created a separate thing. But I think this is the first time that the Saudis have attempted to take over an entire sport, essentially. And that's what concerns folks. Number one, because I think of sort of the sovereignty of U.S. sports, the idea that golf in particular, which sort of has a patina of being honorable and involved with or incorporating certain values that are noble and somewhat above other sports or aside from other sports. I think that's an interesting notion that can be discussed at another time. But it's the idea that to have a foreign country sort of control an entire sport. Imagine if this was the NFL, if someone said in a competing professional football league, I think that there would be even more alarm. And I think that's what people are concerned with. Is this a step to other sports, larger sports being incorporated or basically acquired by a foreign investment fund?
As a non-golfer myself, I think it's interesting that this is the first time that golf has in any way been interesting to me. Because this, way to make golf interesting, guys. But it's interesting because this is an interesting decision that this sport faces. Because on the one hand, you know, the Saudi government is autocratic, does not respect largely the rights of women, of guest workers, of dissidents. You know, they have a habit of kidnapping and cutting up peaceful critics into little pieces inside their embassies. And on the other hand, they're very rich. So I guess this is a decision that the PGA has to make. This is on balance what they have to decide between. Do they follow their conscience or do they follow the funding? Speaking of Michael's characterization of the game as a gentleman's game, I think it does have to be said that the sport has historic issues with race. And also less than 20 years ago, there was a debate about whether female professional players should be allowed to play at the Augusta Golf Club. So it's not exactly the most noble sport to a lot of people who look at it from the outside.
Let me just say, as I say, there is a patina of that. I think that there is a notion that that thing is true, which I totally disagree with, having been, number one, very involved with professional golf and with recreational golf for quite some time, and also being an African American and having seen those things up close and personal. I in no way portray or position the sport as having some sort of halo of virtue around it. I think that the sport does present itself that way. It certainly does. That's not hard to see. But again, as you rightly say, when you have to make hard, tough, very clear moral decisions about do you take the money or do you follow your conscience, which was the original objection of PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan, that he did not want to work with the Saudis and people who were involved with 9/11. To backtrack on that, which is so clearly hypocritical, this is something that really makes it, as you say, for you and for those who are outside the game, quite interesting.
Very good. This has become quite an interesting topic, but I wanted to get our last topic in. House Republicans unloaded a barrage of criticism directed toward FBI Director Christopher Wray on Wednesday, outlining a litany of complaints while Wray testified before the House Judiciary Committee. So what can we expect from these complaints to the FBI director?
Again, it's sort of fascinating to me how the FBI, for a party that had once stood for law and order and had held up the FBI as a bastion, again, we want to talk about a patina of nobility that held the FBI up on a pedestal. The FBI has become an unbelievable whipping boy for the Republican Party. The FBI is accused of being highly, if not completely, politicized in everything from President Trump's indictments to suppressing conservative posts on social media. It's just the flavor of the day for the Republican Party and its whole culture of victimhood. If you feel that you are victimized, that's the place for you. That's what they're doing.
Very interesting. Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Anita, what is weighing on your mind?
Well, I don't think any of us right now know where Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group, is, but I can tell you that that man is living rent-free inside my head. Because this saga, which happened at the end of June, where he called it a march for justice going towards Moscow, the fallout from that is continuing. And key to that is the fate of this one man. And I am just riveted by it because I think it has a lot of implications about Putin's future, the future of the Russia that he has built. And I am just riveted by every reported Prigozhin sighting. It was said that he met with Putin. That's what Putin's spokesman said recently, that he met with Putin a few days after the attempted insurrection, whatever you want to call it. He was supposed to be in Belarus, but Belarus's president said, nope, he's not here either. So maybe our audience should just check under the couch cushions and behind the large furniture to make sure that Yevgeny Prigozhin is not with you right now, because nobody seems to know where he is, and I am obsessed with this case.
Thank you. And Michael?
Well, what's weighing on my mind is actually not necessarily weighing on my mind. I was on a business trip that took me out to the western coast of the United States, so Oregon, and I live in Washington, D.C. Because of the climate change, which is creating record-setting storms, you have these tremendous crowds that are post-COVID, you have crew shortages, all these things are leading to thousands of canceled flights. People have heard about that. I was caught up in the absolute vortex of that. And it took me about 3 days to get from the west coast to the east coast of the United States. It could have been a horror situation, but I did find solace in a couple of things. Number one, remembering that that cross-country trip would have taken months, not days, not so long ago. And I was also encouraged by the resilience of the people that I encountered along the way, from the pilots and flight attendants, the staff in the airports, and certainly the passengers, their willingness to be patient and help each other. I even met people who were strangers before, and now we are friends for life. We're all connected by sort of this jailhouse experience that we went through. And I know that this summer and going forward with climate change not seeming to be on a path to getting any better. These travel woes can get worse and they can weigh on your mind. But in this case, the situation that I went through, the experiences that I had, they actually kind of buoyed my spirit.
Thank you, and thank you both for your comments, and we will end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for more Issues in the News.